She was asking for it. Now you know. You know she was asking for it. You know that. And you know. You know what you might find on this channel on a night like tonight. So I don't want to hear any crying. Oh my God! I can't believe he said that. It's too fucking scary! You know what channel you can go to instead. You know that. I'm not going to say the name because I don't want to hurt feelings. But you know where the kiddie table is. Head on over there if you want to. But tonight, on a night like tonight, I certainly won't be wasting any more of your wonderful time. Good evening. She was asking for it. Now, I've already got some of you upset, but you don't even know what she was asking for. But you know. Maybe she just wanted a cold drink of water. But your mind didn't go there, did it? You're sick. Just as bad as the rest of this perverted society, which will try to destroy her mind, body, and spirit. Now, nothing that happened was her fault. Not the length of her skirt. It was just above the knee. Not the cut of her blouse. There was still room to imagine. Not in the way she walked or talked or anything else. The only thing she was guilty of was having a pretty face. More than a really pretty face. Flawless porcelain skin. Haunting dark eyes and a smile which would entice an angel into sin. The moment I entered the restaurant and saw her bussing tables, I knew what was in store for her. Maybe not tonight, though. Although I wouldn't be surprised considering how she looked, bending over the table to wipe it down. Maybe not tomorrow walking home from class, but sooner or later someone was going to see this goddess and force her into submission. The monsters who do it. You don't think beyond the gratification of the moment. How good it would feel to hold her down while you strip her bare. How soft the skin of her thighs will feel when you crush them in your hands. Her face contorting in the agony of pleasure. You don't think about what it will do to her tomorrow when she's crying herself to sleep. You don't stop and wonder if she will flinch when her lover touches her a year from now. Or whether she can look herself in the mirror without hating what she sees. She smiled at me when she caught me watching. She must have known I was there to protect her. When I slipped into the kitchen after her, it was just a game that made her act surprised. I was her guardian angel, her big brother, the only thing standing between her and all the horrors of this world. I asked her how her night was going, and she said she'd be with me in a minute. It's all good that she was shy, but it wouldn't be enough. Not with a pretty face like that. Even draining the old cooking grease to take outside, she looked like a model. I always adored her. Maybe she was even trying to become one, unwittingly inviting the entire world to fantasize about what they would do to her. I followed her outside, but she didn't notice me. I was starting to get annoyed by this point, but I had to remind myself I was doing this for her good and not my own. Back inside again, she started thinking some things. I could see it on her face. After we've known each other for so many years, it became clear to me I didn't have to hold her down long. 10 seconds in the fresh batch of boiling grease was enough to cure that pretty face. My sister. She struggled hard, but if she couldn't stop me now, she couldn't stop her real attacker in the future. 10 seconds was enough for her skin to start melting into the pan. Nobody was going to hurt her now. Not how she looked after I was done with her. She was asking for it. But now she'll never get it. All because I saved her. All because her big brother looked out for and saved her. I stood in my kitchen staring out the window. My mind a million miles away. I couldn't take the tightness in my chest and the weight of what my husband had suggested to me. My husband David and I have been trying to have a baby for years, but our last visit to the hospital provided the final nails in the coffin after telling us that it wasn't ever going to happen. I was devastated, but my husband didn't seem too upset because he suggested that we had options. I couldn't believe what he was asking of me. Not only me, but also of my sister. When he first mentioned that we asked my sister to be a surrogate, it didn't really come across as the worst idea. But when he suggested we do it the traditional way, it sent my blood running cold. He wants to fuck my sister? A million thoughts ran through my head as I tried to make sense of what he said and what he wanted. Was he attracted to her all this time? Was he using this as a way to sleep with my sister guilt-free? I was furious, and when I said this to him, he didn't see the problem. Told me his ancestors have done it for centuries. Ancestors? Yeah, I've never heard that one before. I don't know any sister-fucking ancestor husbands. I didn't answer him at first. I didn't trust myself to speak without breaking. It was as if David, the man I'd known and loved, was all of a sudden a stranger. It wasn't just the idea of surrogacy that upset me. It was the way he spoke about it, like it was part of some long-forgotten tradition. He wasn't talking about clinics or doctors. He wanted Emily to conceive with him, naturally. I couldn't wrap my head around it. My sister with my husband to give us the child that I couldn't have. The thought made me sick. David had been calm, almost too calm when he explained it. He said it was the family's way, something his ancestors had always done to keep the bloodline strong. The more he talked, the more I felt like I didn't even know him. It wasn't just old-fashioned. It was disturbing. I tried to talk to Emily, hoping she'd be as horrified as I was. And at first, she thought it was a joke. But when I told her how serious David was, her face changed. She admitted that he'd already spoken to her about it. She had hoped he'd drop the idea if I wasn't on board. And now we both knew that it wasn't going away. Anger burned in me. How could David even suggest this? The thought of him with Emily was unbearable, but there was something else, too. Something darker, lurking underneath his words. I couldn't shake the feeling that there was more to his plan than just having a child. I started digging. I went through his things, looking for anything that might explain what was going on. That's when I found the old family records. At first, it seemed like harmless genealogy, but the deeper I looked, the stranger it got. There were symbols I didn't recognize, notes about bloodlines and fertility. And then I found something that chilled me to the bone. Mentions of rituals, sacrifices, and offerings to some kind of ancient god. Suddenly, everything clicked into place. This wasn't about having a child. David wasn't just trying to keep the family line going. He was planning something far darker. My sister wasn't meant to just carry our baby. She was supposed to be a sacrifice. An offering to this old god his family had worshipped for generations. I felt sick. My mind raced as I pieced it all together. David had been planning this for years. His calm demeanor and the talk of tradition, it was all a cover for something far more sinister. I realized I wasn't just fighting to stop an uncomfortable surrogacy arrangement. I was fighting for my sister's life. When I confronted him, he didn't deny it. He just looked at me with that same eerie calm, saying it was the only way to secure the family's future. Emily had to be the one. She was pure, perfect for the ritual. He spoke like it was already decided, like I had no say in the matter. The desperation in me turned to panic, a gnawing fear that was eating away at me. I had to protect Emily, but I wasn't sure how obsessed my husband was about all this and the lengths he could go to make it happen. Time was running out, and I knew that if I didn't stop him, I'd lose Emily. And if that happened, the consequences would be far worse than anything I could have ever imagined. The night of the ritual came. David had prepared everything, symbols drawn on the floor, candles flickering in strange, unnatural patterns. Emily stood off to the side, trembling, terrified of what was about to happen. I was shaking too, but not out of fear. I was ready. David had no idea how much I had learned, how far I had gone to turn this around. He thought I was beaten, that I had accepted his plan. He had no idea that while he was busy obsessing over his precious old ways, I had been finding something older and something stronger. As David began to chant, my heart pounded in my chest, but I stayed silent, watching him call on forces he didn't fully understand. He moved toward Emily, ready to start the final part of the ritual, but that's when I made my move. I spoke words he wasn't expecting, words I had learned from the darkest parts of those ancient texts. They weren't meant for me to say, but I had learned to twist the ritual, bend it to my own will. I had spent weeks preparing for this moment, memorizing everything I needed to make sure that he would be the one who paid the price. David froze as the energy in the room shifted. The symbols on the floor flickered, changing shape, twisting into something unfamiliar even to him. His confidence wavered, and for the first time I saw fear in his eyes. He tried to finish the chant, but the words fell flat. "You don't understand what you're doing," he tried to shout. But his control over the ritual was slipping. The power he'd summoned didn't care for tradition or purity. It was only looking for one thing: the perfect vessel. David gasped, his face twisted in shock. The ritual had shifted, and he was no longer the master of it. He tried to stand, but his body convulsed again, and he fell to his knees. His hands pressed against his belly as something inside him began to swell, pushing outward. The horrifying realization dawned on him. The life he had intended for my sister was now growing inside him. I watched as his belly expanded, stretching his skin tight. The weight of it grew heavy and undeniable. He looked up at me, his face pale, desperate for a way out, but there was none. The spell had made its choice. David, the man so obsessed with controlling his bloodline, was now the one carrying it. "Yeah. Enjoy having the baby yourself, you motherfucker." The look of terror on his face was all I needed to know. He understood, and there was no escaping it. He was pregnant. 9 months later, David was a shadow of the man he used to be. His once proud posture had crumbled under the weight of his massive, swollen belly, his skin stretched tight and marked with deep stretch marks. His feet were constantly swollen, and his face, once stern, was now puffy and exhausted from sleepless nights of cramps, back pain, and the relentless discomfort of carrying life inside him. He had gone through every stage of pregnancy, morning sickness that left him heaving, strange cravings, and the unpredictable mood swings that left him either weeping or raging at the smallest things. He had tits bigger than mine. It was unbelievable. His body ached in ways he'd never imagined, his back hunched as he waddled through the house, barely able to move with the burden of his own making. The reality of pregnancy had shattered any last trace of his arrogance, leaving him humbled and broken. Me and my sister are out of here. My dad was drunk again. Rain swept over my windshield like waves over a beach as I drove him home from yet another bar where he'd made a fool of himself. He wasn't the drunken brawler type. Nah, he was a crier. He'd sit at the bar with his head on the table and just start sobbing, wailing, bringing down the whole mood of the place. Even now, he shifted between crying and sniffling while staring out the passenger window, and half-conscious states where he couldn't muster the mental coherence to even register such complex emotions. At one point, He even leaned over the center console and tried to hug me, almost making me jerk the steering wheel. "Dad, no, Christ, I'm trying to drive over here," I snapped at him. "Keep on your half of the car or I'm pulling over." Like a loyal dog, he recognized the tone of my words, even if not their meaning, and shrunk back sheepishly. Since I was in elementary school, people told me I was remarkably mature for my age. But you kind of have to be, when you're forced to act like the parent of the family. The road traveled parallel to our local river, the one the school kids all called the Devil's Gutter. It snaked in and out of sight behind the tree line, and it liked to taunt every driver that passed. The damn thing was evil, I knew, but I couldn't help but feel a certain nostalgic fondness for it. It was the only thing offering any sense of danger and mystique to what would have otherwise been the least interesting small town in the country. From a glance, it seemed mild, shallow and narrow enough to make it across with a leap. There was no way of telling that it was actually hundreds of feet deep, that the undercurrent was stronger than an Olympic swimmer could withstand, that the banks were undercut and impossible to climb back up once you were in, that the carbonated water had intricately carved networks of hundreds of channels and caves deep into the limestone. Misjudge your leap, and you'd be seized by the undercurrent, dashed against the rocks, plunged deep into some dark cave with which your body would be preserved forever, pinned to a wall or ceiling of stone like some decoration. The gutter features in our every folktale and ghost story. When I was a kid, we liked to tell the tale of old Bart O'Neill, a 19th century prospector whose cat was apparently very popular with the neighborhood Toms. Every time she'd get knocked up, it was said, he'd gather up the kittens into a burlap sack and toss them all into the Devil's Gutter. At least, and this was when whoever was telling the story would lower their voice to a whisper, until they found his body in his bed, shredded by hundreds of small claws. His eyes had been clawed out, his fingers bitten off like carrots, his rib cage torn open. And within his chest, the police found dozens of tiny poops. That's right. According to legend, the spectral kittens had used his chest cavity as a litter box. That was all made up, of course. The crude invention of imaginative schoolboys. But I have looked through old newspapers and found that someone named Bart O'Neill really did disappear from town a long while ago. No gory details, just up and vanished. The only oddity I noticed was that when his cat was found still locked up in a cage in his shed a week after his disappearance, it was well fed, as if somebody had been sneaking in and caring for it. And this is why I hate taking this road. With every glimpse of that river, my mind wanders back to old memories, terrible memories, ones that would have been better left forgotten. It ignites a fire in me, a sort of morbid curiosity I've come to dread. But then my dad broke my line of thought with a long, obnoxiously loud groan. And then I was thinking of the first time I had him in my passenger seat when I was some anxiety-ridden kid, no older than 15. Didn't even have my driver's license yet. My hand shaking late that New Year's night as I struggled to dodge all the other drunk morons swerving all over the road. New Year's was always the worst night for him. "This would have been our anniversary," he was groaning. "It would have been our 15th. I got over what happened to Mom over a decade ago. Why couldn't he? We aren't the only people who've experienced loss anyway. When I was growing up, the whole town mourned the death of Annabelle, captain of our high school cheerleading squad. She had tried to jump the gutter and even cleared it, but there'd just been rain, and the muddy opposite bank gave way beneath her feet, and she went right in. Crazy thing was, 15 minutes later, they got a ping from some SOS beacon her mother had made her wear. They took this as proof she'd made it out alive but injured, and triggered a frantic search of the surrounding area, with no luck, though. There were rumors, however improbable, that she'd found her way into an air pocket somewhere in that limestone cave system, just close enough to the surface that just one of her desperate calls for help managed to make it through. Sometimes I picture her down there, in a kind of darkness I cannot fathom, struggling to keep her head above the water. I wonder if she knew that surrounding her, somewhere in the dark, were the corpses of those who had been pulled into those caves before her. I picture a gaunt, bleached hand brushing her ankle as those currents carry one by. I imagine her crowded on all sides by the gaunt, empty eyes of the people who'd found their way into that air pocket before her and never found their way out. Maybe it was for the best that she would have been in complete darkness. And there my mind went again. I'd gotten another glimpse of the river and couldn't help but imagine Anna down there, as if her eyes were looking up at me from beneath those blackened waters. I tried to turn up the radio to take my mind off it and to drown out my dad's moaning and sobbing, but he grunted as if the very sound offended him and drunkenly pawed at the dashboard until he turned it back off. I already knew what he'll say tomorrow. "I've let you down," he'd say, head down like a dog caught peeing on the carpet. "I've never been the father I should have been." And it'll all be very genuine and very sincere and very, very, very temporary. I've even helped pay for his rehab once. He'd been found choked half to death on his own vomit. "This is a wake-up call," he'd say. "I'm finally ready to be the dad you've always needed me to be." A few grand seemed like a small price to pay to have my dad back. And indeed, for a few months of sobriety, he was the best dad on earth. The best I could have asked for. And then came New Year's again, and it was suddenly like none of it ever happened. My eyes glimpsed across set up along the gutter, a bouquet left at its base. I knew exactly who it was for. When I was in fourth grade, Bethany, a little girl who went to the same school as me, was swallowed up by the gutter. Her father was the only one who witnessed the accident, and there'd been some suspicious circumstances. I don't really remember. Something about marital issues, custody, that sort of thing. Point was, everybody thought it was him. But what proof did we have? The gutter never parts with its secrets. 3 years or so later, her dad just up and vanished too. Nobody thought much of it at first. Everyone assumed he got tired of the side eyes and just skipped town. But then, months after everyone had forgotten about the whole thing, someone started sending around a voicemail he'd apparently sent out at 3 in the morning, the night he disappeared. It apparently had been sent to some random coworker from his contacts list. An accident, clearly. The first minute or two just consisted of the sort of rustling you'd expect from a pocket dial, so they hadn't thought much of it. It hadn't been until their curiosity drove them to investigate deeper that they realized they could hear the dad's heavy, belabored breathing and the sounds of twigs and leaves cracking beneath his feet, as if he were wandering through the middle of the woods. Moreover, off in the distance, they could hear another voice. The faint voice of a little girl, bubbly and giggling like they were playing a game. "Daddy," the voice kept crying out into the night. "Daddy, where are you?" They noticed, too, that you couldn't hear any crickets or birds or anything else you'd expect out in the forest at night. Everything was dead silent, like all the creatures of the woods sensed the presence of a predator. The dad's breathing grew heavier and more panicked whenever the voice grew louder, nearer, but it remained stifled, as if he was desperately trying to keep quiet and remain unnoticed. Eventually, she was so close that you could hear her little footsteps in the leaves, and the dad didn't even dare to breathe. And then the sound of branches being parted, the father's gasp, and that little voice laughing and declaring in a sing-song tone, "Daddy, I found you." And at that exact moment, the voicemail reached its time limit. The cop's official line was that it was a fake, just some audio doctored up by bored teenagers to feed into the sensationalized mythology of the devil's gutter. But Bethany's relatives swore up and down that they recognized that giggly little voice, and it was unmistakable. Lost in thought, I blinked, and somehow, in an instant, a woman appeared in the middle of the road. I can't remember the next few seconds. It was as if I'd time-traveled. One moment, I was driving along, and the next, I was stuck in a muddy ditch on the roadside, the hood just inches away from an oak tree sturdy enough to have bisected my car. And Dad was screaming like a madman, incoherently at first, but then congealing into a name. "Jessica," he was screaming out for Mom. "Jessica." And as he screamed, he threw open the passenger side door and tore off into the woods with a drunken stumble. When I glanced in the rearview mirror, the woman was still standing there in the road, a vague silhouette barely illuminated by whatever moonlight broke through the storm. But when I looked back with my own eyes, she was gone. I cursed like a sailor as I took off into the storm, blindly in the direction I thought my dad had went. My heart was in my throat. We were so close to the gutter. In his state, he could so easily fall in and become just another name in its long list. Another creepy story to tell on school playgrounds. But then it became clear I was in the same danger. The storm was rapidly picking up, sideways rain blasting my eyes and wind tugging at the trees by their roots. Yet somehow, stupidly, what terrified me most was the prospect that, while stumbling through those darkened woods, I might hear a little girl's voice off in the distance shouting, "Daddy." Suddenly, I froze in place. I realized I could hear the bubbling and crashing of the gutter's current, even over the storm. It must be so close. I tried to look for it, but the rain seared my eyes whenever I was not covering them with an arm. I was too terrified to take a step in any direction, but the storm took action for me by sweeping away the mud beneath my feet. Anna's fate flashed in my mind, the muddy bank giving way. My death wasn't even going to be original. I thrashed and floundered, feeling the earth seem to envelope me from below like a massive creature, pulling me into its gullet. Through sheer luck, my random grabs caught purchase. A thick, sturdy tree root was all that saved me from the waters below, and I clung to it with every scrap of strength I had, even as the rain left it soaked and slippery. I managed to hold on for a while, with no way back up, but unwilling to let go of my only lifeline. And then I felt the cold hand wrap around my ankle. My body tensed with such horror that I lost my grip in an instant, and those cruel waters had me. They seemed to toy with me for a while, spinning me about under the surface as I curled up into the fetal position. The shock of the frigid cold caused me to suck down a breath instinctively, filling my lungs with water. As I scratched at my chest, my eyes opened for just a split second. On either side of me were those thick limestone walls, pockmarked with the black abysses that were caves. And that limestone led down below, far below, disappearing into that infinite, inky blackness beneath me. The experts' guesses must have been wrong. The gutter couldn't just be a few hundred feet deep. It had to be a mile, at the very least. Just looking down into that darkness, I felt the same sense of vertigo as I'd felt looking down from the roof of the Empire State Building. That, and an overwhelming sense of things looking up at me, staring back. It reminded me of joining the theater group as a kid, standing on a stage for the first time and realizing that there were over 100 pairs of eyes on me, watching me, expecting a performance. Except this time, I knew they were here to watch me die, watch me become one of them, sink down far below the surface and join them in all that darkness, never to see sunlight again, except vaguely through the surface of the water, miles above my new home. But even that didn't tear me quite as much as the prospect of landing in one of those caves. Even as the undercurrent bashed me savagely against rocks and my lungs cried out for air, my only focus was avoiding them. I swear I could see bloated arms and grasping hands reaching out from the dark of each cave, grasping for me as I passed by, as if each occupant was lonely, desperate for a companion in their eternal resting places. Suddenly, the current bashed my head against a rock, and from then, everything was abstract and fuzzy. I could only muster a single coherent thought. "Please, not here," it went. "Don't let me die here." Somehow I knew that if I died beneath these waters, my soul would never break the surface. As if to answer my prayer, a pair of arms settled around me. Not the cold, grasping claws reaching from the caves, but something warm and comfortable, embracing me, cradling me close in a way that told me everything would be okay. Again, the next few seconds were a blur. I have no explanation for how I ended up back on the shore, shivering from the freezing waters and hacking, retching, emptying the water from my lungs upon the mud. All I know is, when I looked up, a bolt of lightning briefly illuminated the stone memorial looming above me, upon which it read, "In loving memory of Jessica Whitaker." I know everything about the mythology of Devil's Gutter because I was a part of it. My family is one of the ones the school kids would whisper about. The ones they make up wild stories and creepy theories about. Terminal cancer, they'd say around campfires. It was so horribly painful that not even the morphine could do anything for her. She'd been a painter, you know, always drawing portraits of the gutter. She was the only person who thought it was beautiful, not evil. And so the legend goes, she begged her husband, please take me to the river. Let me become part of it. They say they did it on their anniversary, New Year's Day. I heard a long, choking rasp. For a moment, I was almost relieved. I thought it was another one of my father's drunken groans, and then I realized it was coming from the river itself. I turned and beheld a dozen hands reaching out over the side of the banks, unnameable things pulling themselves up from the waters. I only caught vague glimpses of the crawling, groaning creatures, briefly illuminated by the lightning. Their skins were bleached white and transparent, looking like road maps made of veins and arteries, stretched taut over gray muscles and jagged ribs and putrid organs. Many were missing legs, arms, and even heads. Others were more ancient still, mummified strands of flesh seemingly loosely stitched to the crumbling remains of a skeletal structure. All seemed to be looking right at me, even though none of them had any eyes to speak of, only empty black sockets. They were crawling forwards with horrid determination. Once the gutter had taken you into its waters, laid its claim to you, it never wanted to let you go. They were only coming to retrieve what they were owed. I tried to crawl away through the mud, but it felt like crawling in a bad dream. It felt like the very planet was turning sideways, gravity itself guiding me back towards the river. Then a figure burst through the woods, large and heavy-set. My father. He stumbled into the middle of the crowd of the dead, waving his arms, trying to seize their attention. Take me! Take me, not them! He was screaming, like a man possessed, but they didn't even seem to notice him. They were dead set on me, blind to the rest of the world. Then he turned to the lake, and my eyes followed his gaze. To the woman from the road. Now her silhouette was standing in the middle of the river, seeming to hover a few inches above the water, her dress billowing in the wind. Jessica! Tell them to take me! He let out a primal, raw scream, one that must have torn his throat to shreds. I don't want to hurt anymore. She calmly beckoned him with a finger, and in that moment, he knew what he had to do. He didn't even hesitate. He went sliding down the bank, and for a moment, he seemed to stand upon those bubbling, surging waters, just like she did. His arms were stretched wide as he stumbled forward, as if ready to embrace her. And then I blinked, and they were gone. So too disappeared that legion of the dead. It seemed like they'd accepted a trade, one soul for the other. The gutter always took its due. It would have been easy to tell everyone that my dad had just stumbled stupidly into the gutters during another one of his drunken events, but I wanted people to remember his sacrifice. I weaved some tale of me falling in and him jumping in after me and hoisting me out, even at the cost of his own life. It didn't make a lot of sense, I admit, and some people even suspected me for a while. But eventually, everybody just accepted the idea of him being a hero in his last moments, getting some redemption in the last bit. People like when stories get wrapped up in neat little bows. Sometimes I still dream about the two of them, floating in the center of some underwater cave chamber, yet somehow illuminated by moonlight. And by the walls of the chamber all lined with glowing, pinprick white eyes, like stars in the sky. Dead, but not dead. The current still flowing around them, animating them like marionettes, spinning them around each other, and my mother in my father's arms like a waltz, the way they were on their wedding day. Dancing, dancing, on and on forever, before their audience of the dead. I'd been working maintenance for a few years by the time I got done with college. Mostly just garbage pickup and stuff like that, at apartment complexes my dad was in charge of in central Arizona. The pay was okay, and I got my own little place where I was living with my girlfriend. It was all pretty good in its own right, but I wasn't making too terribly much, and we'd never been able to take a vacation or anything on our own. It was on a Wednesday when I saw an ad in my city newspaper for a pool boy in a little place a few miles out of town for almost twice what I was making, doing all the other maintenance work I already was. I almost immediately called the number the paper mentioned and was greeted by a calm-sounding man, probably in his mid-40s. When I inquired about the job, he seemed to become even happier, and we set up a meeting time. That Saturday, we met at his place, a big open house with lots of windows and all the latest appliances. He seemed to be a pretty nice guy. Rich, too, obviously. When I asked why he was offering so much just to monitor his pool, he replied that he had just let his last guy go and his pool always needed surveillance because he had a young daughter and she had a lot of friends. That sort of thing. I accepted the job almost instantly and was gladly up at his place right after my 2-week notice passed at my dad's. Work was pretty smooth for the first few weeks, my new employer being much more understanding of circumstances than my old man was allowed to be, due to the rules and regulations every employee had to follow at his complex. I could go in and cool off when it seemed too hot outside. He always kept his fridge stocked with water, and it all seemed exceedingly comfortable. I would occasionally make small talk with the maid. She couldn't speak English very well, but one day when I asked her, she told me the boss was a cosmetic surgeon, obviously a very wealthy one at that. As a personal rule, I'm generally against that kind of stuff and admittedly grimaced at the prospect of working for someone whose money came from boob jobs. Still, he seemed like a nice, settled-in family man, and the pay was good, so I let it be. About 2 months in, I was clearing some sand and other sorts of residue out of the bottom of the pool, faintly hearing the sound of a piano inside. The doc's window was wide open, and he was overseeing his daughter practicing. I tried not to snoop, but work was taking longer than expected, and the music was pleasant until it suddenly stopped. I could hear the doctor calmly explaining to the daughter what she did wrong, but in an instant she was screaming at him that she wanted to stop. It hadn't occurred to me until then that she had been playing the entire morning. This in mind, I couldn't help but listen in just a little over the sound of my pool vacuum. He started shouting and threatening to ground her, to take her dolls away. I caught something that I didn't quite understand, something about her big Barbie, or something like that. When I began to hear the music again, I went back to cleaning out the pool, trying to forget what I had just heard. Though I tried to make good on this attempt, I decided I'd be on the watch for this kind of thing in the future. I know parents snap at their children and all, but if this turned into abuse, someone was going to hear about it. Sometime thereafter, I was inside getting a drink when I got a good look at a photo on the refrigerator. I had never noticed before, showing the doctor, his daughter and two of the women. Sometime thereafter, I was inside getting a drink when I got a good look at a photo on the refrigerator. I had never noticed it before. It showed the doctor, his daughter, and two of the women, one in her 40s or 50s and the other a teenager. Judging by the doc's youngest daughter, it looked fairly recent. I asked the maid about it, and in the best broken English she could give me, she said the older woman was the doctor's wife, and the younger his older daughter. I hated to keep asking questions, given her difficulty speaking to me, but I pressed on just a little more to ask why I never saw them around. Now, with difficulty, not only speaking but recalling, she told me the doctor's daughter was killed in a car crash a year ago. His wife killed herself shortly thereafter. This shocked and horrified me. And suddenly I couldn't help but feel a new sense of compassion for the doctor and his daughter. Soon as I was hydrated, I went right back to work, wondering if I'd ever seen much sign of grief from the two. Maybe that's why the doctor was so uptight about some things with his daughter. Maybe that's why she clung to her toys the way she did. I happened to clean out bits of Barbie toys from the pool on what seemed like a weekly basis. Overall, it was just a lot to take in. Time went on and my work continued. I had never imagined doing what I did as a year-round job. I used to live in the Midwest. Pools usually closed around Labor Day. But down here, they were open all the time, and the doc's kid and her friends just kept coming over. One day, doing my usual work, I noticed a large splotch at the bottom of the pool for what must have been the third time. I was irritated and reluctantly accepted normal chlorine wasn't going to do the trick. I had to shock it. Shock is a form of superchlorine, several times stronger than the average stuff. I checked the doc's notes, and they did indeed confirm that he had some of the stuff I needed. It was kept in the basement. Seemed like an odd place for it, but I digress. Maybe it was to keep it out of his daughter's hands. Speaking of the doc's daughter, my eye caught her and a couple of her friends about to jump in the pool. I had to shout at them to stop, and she threw a fit at me for doing so. I just figured the splotch in the pool would be a bacterial breeding ground, and I wasn't letting the little kids in it. I found my maid friend again, and now, frantic to make the pool clean for the boss's daughter, asked her where the basement was. She responded with a confused look. I tried several other phrases. My high school Spanish long lost, until she recognized the word cellar. She led me outside after I mentioned it and pointed me to a dingy little trapdoor in the ground, connected to the house right next to the hose. I had never noticed it there before, and it was tightly bound with what appeared to be shiny new chains, with very little dirt on them. I tried to ask her how I was supposed to open it, but we both lacked the vocabulary to communicate properly at that point. I was about to bitterly accept defeat, leave the doc a note, and tell him not to worry about paying me that day, until his daughter walked up on me. She said she had a key to the cellar. Now, I was confused by this right from the get-go, and even more so when she mentioned I couldn't tell her dad that she did, but I wanted to get back to work, so I agreed to her conditions. I was in the dimly lit cellar a few minutes later, as she shouted at me to not play with any of her toys. Why would she have toys down here? Was this where her dad kept her stuff when she was in trouble? Was that why she wasn't supposed to have a key? I fumbled around in the dark for a while, the light from outside only helping me so much, desperately looking for a light switch. As I continued to wander around, I ultimately felt myself pushing up against something. It felt like a wall, but there was no weight behind it. Not entirely sure what I was doing, I pushed against it and suddenly toppled into another passage. Confused, disoriented, and growing increasingly frightened, I felt around for a switch again and quickly found one on the wall. Despite the short time I had spent in the cellar, I was briefly blinded when I switched the thing on. But more so when I got a good look at the room. That was not just some dingy cellar I had walked into. The thing extended beneath the house and was filled, to my shock and slight disturbance, with oversized pink and white furniture. My jaw was agape as I searched around, finding a fully functioning bathroom, den, and everything. The rooms were much smaller than they had been upstairs, but they were still comparable to a decent hotel's. Why on earth did the doctor have all this down here? I wandered through just a little more, too shocked by what I had seen to turn back, when I came upon a bedroom. Of course, everything was still pink and huge, and this room even included a closet full of clothes. But the most notable feature present was what appeared to be a giant cardboard box sitting in the room's center. In sloppy handwriting, the box read, "My favorite Barbie." I did not want to open that box. I swore at myself for dropping down and grabbing the bottom of the cardboard cube, my conscience screaming to put the damn thing down and find whatever I had come for. I couldn't even remember what it was, though. But I just had to know what all this was for. I wish I'd never taken this job. I wish I'd never gone into that cellar. I wish I'd never opened that fucking box. I screamed and scrambled away the instant I saw what I did. Standing before me, at almost exactly my height, was a Barbie doll. I struggled to catch my breath as I stared at the thing. I was full of doubt Mattel had made anything like this, but the likeness was nearly perfect to the dolls I'd been seeing around the house. Her eyes were wide open and green. She had long blonde hair and bright pink lips smiling. Still trying to take it in, I noticed the doll was naked. It had oversized breasts without any nipples. Heart pounding, I noticed something along the doll's back. I slowly went behind it to take a look, seeing a large, bulbous thing sticking out of its back, almost like a button. Letting curiosity defeat me once again, I gently pressed it. "Help me," the doll screamed in a shrill voice. I ran from it towards the door, not even so much shocked by the scream as what I had felt. I had touched flesh. No, that was impossible. This thing appeared to gleam like plastic a moment ago. There's no way that was real. But as I continued to back away, my fears were confirmed. I could see the doll's chest expanding and contracting. The doll was breathing. The doll was real. My jaw dropped, tears starting to well up in my eyes. This was not happening. What the fuck was I even looking at? Struggling to accept all that was before me, I darted around the moment I could hear footsteps over my pounding heart. There was the doctor, just a few feet behind me, holding a syringe. "Well then," he muttered, "I guess you found our playroom." I gently slid a hand into my pocket as I insisted that he tell me what was going on. Ensuring he couldn't see, I managed to worm my cell phone out of my pocket. Without a hint of sadness or remorse in his voice, the doctor told his tale, chilling me to the bone as I managed to trigger the video camera on my phone. The doctor told me that he desired the same thing any other parent does, to have the perfect child. He told me how it all seemed to be going well with his older daughter. She started to rebel in her teenage years. Her grades started to slip in high school, and he caught her having sex on the living room couch. He was so overwhelmed by her misbehavior, he was ready to give up on her entirely. He told me he was convinced if he pampered his younger daughter, surely she would behave right. A Christmas before last, he asked her what she wanted. She said she wanted a big Barbie doll that could do anything she told it to, and that would play with her all the time. The doctor told me how he spent a month and a half planning what he'd do, planning how to pamper his younger and punish his older. My wife found out at one point, all for the best though. I was planning on just bringing some fat collagen home from work, but I think she worked out much more smoothly. He told me how he staged the disappearance of his daughter while he sedated and put her under the knife. He spent over a week getting everything just right before he surprised his younger daughter with the playmate she always wanted. "It's in exchange for just being my perfect little angel." My jaw was slack, too horrified of it all to move. Why was he going on and on? Was he bragging about this disgusting accomplishment? He talked and talked about how she'd been living off juices and purees he made, how her eyes were glass and hand-painted, how he tried to just leave in the originals, but she cried too much, and her younger pointed out her toy didn't blink, and how she had little chips throughout her body that would give her a brutal shock if she used her vocal cords and he didn't press the button first. "You're gonna fry, you sick son of a bitch," I shouted. "What the fuck is wrong with you?" "Well, of course, I wouldn't tell you all this if I was going to let you leave," he said with a smile. "I've needed a matching Ken doll, you know." I tried to swallow, but my mouth was dry. "Now come here and take your medicine." He was unexpectedly strong and managed to tackle me quickly, knocking the phone out of my hand. The needle came deathly close, but despite the momentary advantage, I had the weight edge to force him off of me and grab my phone. Much as I had wanted to help the poor mutilated girl, I had to save myself first, running fast as I could out of the basement to my car. Fast as I've ever driven in my life, I pulled out of the doctor's driveway and slammed the gas the moment I shifted into drive. About a minute later, I could hear the sound of a shotgun firing in the distance. I managed to make it back into town, cars everywhere, long before I saw anything of the doctor in my rearview. I pulled into the police station and flipped open my phone, searching for the evidence to incarcerate this insane bastard, only to find my SD card had been destroyed when he tackled me. I had nothing to give the police but my testimony, and even in my head, I knew it was too mad to be true. I then drove to my parents' place that night, the house empty. I assumed they were gone on a date or something. I searched around in my dad's room and found his revolver. I don't remember much more of the night, but my girlfriend tells me I was extremely on edge and constantly looking out the window. 3 days after my horrifying discovery, I drove back to the house, armed, ready to pay the doctor back for his crime against humanity. When I arrived, however, the house was entirely abandoned. No sign of anyone anywhere, and when I checked the horrors of the cellar, the doll and its box were gone. I found one of the doctor's business cards while snooping and made a call to his office that night. The receptionist said he had left on a very short notice with no real explanation. That was about a year ago. I've spent I don't know how many sleepless nights with what I had experienced in that basement. I'm only mentioning this now because on Yahoo.com's newsfeed, I found an article about a pool boy in southern Florida mysteriously disappearing. There were tearful testimonies from his family and his employer, speaking all the while with his daughter within audible range, bragging to her friends that she was getting a Ken doll for her favorite Barbie.